Chapter 28. The Final Adventures of Korovyov and Behemoth. It is impossible to say for sure whether these silhouettes were real or whether the panic-stricken residents of the ill-fated apartment building on Sadovaya had simply imagined them. Even if they did exist, no one knew their subsequent destination. Nor can we say where they split up. But what we do know is that approximately 15 minutes after the fire started on Sadovaya, a tall gentleman in a checked suit appeared by the mirrored doors of the Turksin foreign currency store on Smolensky Market. He was accompanied by a large black cat. Weaving deftly through the crowd, the gentleman opened the outer door of the store. But a small, bony, and extremely hostile doorman blocked his path and said irritably, "No cats."
"I beg pardon," rattled the tall man, cupping his knotty hand to his ear as if he were hard of hearing. "No cats, you say? Where do you see a cat?"
The doorman's eyes bulged out, and with good reason. Instead of a cat at the gentleman's feet, a fat man in a torn cap was peeking out from behind his shoulder, rearing to get inside the store. True, his face had a somewhat feline appearance. In his hands, the fat man had a Primus. For some reason, the misanthropic doorman took an instant dislike to this couple.
"We only accept foreign currency," he rasped, glaring from underneath his shaggy grey eyebrows that looked as if they had been eaten by moths.
"My dear fellow," the tall man rattled, his eye flashing beneath a cracked pince-nez. "How do you know we have no foreign currency? Are you judging by our dress? Never do that, my precious guardian of doors. You might make a mistake, and a big one at that. Read up on the story of the famous Caliph Harun al-Rashid, and you'll see what I mean. But tossing that story aside for the moment, I would like to tell you that I will complain to your supervisor and tell him such things about you that you may well be forced to leave your comfortable post by these shiny mirrored doors."
"I might have a whole primus full of currency,"
the plump, cat-like man interrupted heatedly, shoving his way into the store. An irritated line had already formed behind them. Glaring at the odd couple with suspicion and hatred, the doorman stepped aside, and our friends, Korovyov and Behemoth, found themselves inside the store. First they looked around, and then Korovyov announced in a ringing voice heard in every corner,
"An excellent store, a very, very fine store."
For some reason, the people at the counters turned and stared at the speaker in amazement, even though he had every reason to praise the store. Hundreds of varieties of richly coloured chintz lay in square shelf compartments. Beyond them towered piles of calico, chiffon, and various suit fabrics. Stacks of shoeboxes stretched into the distance, where several women were sitting on low chairs, wearing an old worn shoe on one foot and a shiny new one on the other, which they stamped on the rug with a preoccupied air. Somewhere around a corner, gramophones played and sang in the distance. But Korovyov and Behemoth went past all these delights and made straight for the junction of the grocery and confectionery departments. There was lots of space here. Ladies in scarves and berets did not crowd the counters as they did in the fabrics department. A short, perfectly square man was standing by a counter and droning on authoritatively. Extremely clean-shaven, he was wearing horn-rimmed spectacles, an unruffled, unstained, brand-new hat, a lilac coat, and orange kid gloves. A salesman in a clean white coat and blue cap was serving the lilac customer. Using an extremely sharp knife, very similar to the one stolen by Matthew Levi, he was removing the silvery snake-like skin from a fat, juicy, pink piece of salmon.
"This department is superb as well," Korovyov acknowledged solemnly. "And what a charming foreigner," he said, pointing benevolently at the lilac coat.
"No, forgot no," Behemoth said pensively. "You are mistaken, my friend. The lilac gentleman's face lacks something, in my opinion."
The lilac coat flinched, presumably by accident, for surely the foreigner could not have understood the Russian words spoken by Korovyov and his companion.
"Is good?"
the lilac customer inquired sternly. "World class," replied the salesman, playfully poking under the salmon skin with the edge of his knife.
"Good I like, bad no,"
the foreigner warned sternly. "But of course," the salesman replied enthusiastically. Our friends left the foreigner and his salmon and approached the confectionery counter.
"Hot out today,"
Karofiov said to a young red-cheeked salesgirl, but received no reply.
"How much are the oranges?"
he then inquired.
30 kopecks a kilo," answered the salesgirl.
"Everyone wants a bite of your wallet,"
Karofiov noted, sighing.
"Oh, dear, oh, dear."
He pondered a while longer and extended an invitation to his companion.
"Eat up, Behemoth."
The fat man tucked the primus under his arm, obtained the top orange in the pyramid, wolfed it down, skin and all, and immediately moved on to the next. A deathly fear came over the salesgirl.
"Are you crazy?" she cried, the colour in her cheeks fading. "I need a receipt first, a receipt!"
And she dropped her pastry tongs.
"My darling, my sweet, my prettiest,"
Karofiov began hoarsely, leaning over the counter and winking at the salesgirl.
"We don't happen to have any foreign currency today. What's a man to do? But the next time we're here, no later than Monday, I swear we'll pay you back in cash. We live right around here, on Sadovaya, in the building that just caught fire."
Swallowing the third orange, Behemoth thrust his paw into an elaborate structure built from chocolate bars and pulled out the bottom one, which of course caused the entire thing to collapse. He then swallowed the bar together with its gold wrapper. The salesmen at the fish counters froze with their knives in their hands. The lilac foreigner turned towards the marauders, revealing that Behemoth had been wrong. The lilac man's face lacked nothing. On the contrary, it had something superfluous. Hanging jowls and shifty eyes. Turning yellow, the salesgirl screamed miserably for the whole store to hear.
"Pelosic! Pelosic!"
The crowd from the fabric department came running at the scream. Meanwhile, Behemoth abandoned the tempting confectioneries and stuck his paw in a barrel bearing the inscription, "Select Kirsch Herring." He pulled out a couple of herring and swallowed them, spitting out the tails.
"Pelosic!"
came another desperate cry from behind the confectionery stand, while at the fish counter, a goateed salesman barked,
"What do you think you're doing, you scum?"
Pavel Yosifovich was already hurrying to the scene. He was an imposing, surgeon-like man in a clean white coat with a pencil sticking out of his pocket. He was evidently an experienced man as well. Seeing the tail of the third herring in Behemoth's mouth, he quickly assessed the situation and understood everything. Without getting into any arguments with the insolent bastards, he waved into the distance and commanded,
"Blow the whistle!"
The doorman shot out of the mirrored doors onto the corner of Smolensky and exploded in sinister whistling. The crowd began to close around the scoundrels, but then Karofiov stepped in.
"Folks!"
he shouted in a high-pitched, vibrating voice.
"What's going on here, huh? I want to ask you something. This poor man..."
Karofiov put a tremor into his voice and pointed to Behemoth, who immediately put on a sad face.
"This poor man mends primuses all day for a living. He's hungry. But where is he to get foreign currency?"
"Hey, none of that,"
the usually calm and composed Pavel Yosifovich shouted sternly. Growing impatient, he waved into the distance and the whistling by the doors intensified. Unfazed by Pavel Yosifovich's interjection, Karofiov continued.
"Where? I ask you all. He's tormented by hunger and thirst. He's hot. So the poor guy sampled an orange which costs a measly 3 kopecks. And here they go, whistling like nightingales in the spring woods, disturbing the police, taking them away from important business. Why is he allowed here, huh?"
And Karofiov pointed at the lilac fat man, who grew most alarmed.
"Who is he, huh? Where did he come from? Why, as if we couldn't live without him, as if we invited him here.
bellowed the former choirmaster at the top of his lungs, his mouth twisted in a sarcastic smile.
Sure, he's got a smart lilac suit. He's all bloated with salmon and stuffed with foreign currency. But what about our boys? What about our boys? I'm bitter, folks. Bitter! Bitter!
Wailed Korofioff, like the best man at an old-fashioned wedding. This silly, tactless, and probably politically subversive speech made Pavel Yosifovich shake with indignation. But, oddly enough, the looks of the customers made it clear that it evoked sympathy in the crowd. And when Behemoth wiped his eyes with his dirty, torn sleeve and exclaimed tragically,
"Thank you, my faithful friend, for looking out for the victim,"
a miracle happened. A quiet, respectable little old man, dressed poorly but neatly, who had been buying 3 almond pastries at the confectionery counter, underwent a sudden transformation. His eyes flashed with bellicose fire, he turned purple, threw his little bag of pastries on the floor, and shouted in a high-pitched, childlike voice, "He's right!" He snatched the tray containing the remains of the chocolate bar Eiffel Tower, ruined by Behemoth, and waved it in the air. Tearing off the foreigner's hat with his left hand, he brought the tray down on the exposed bald head with his right, producing a sound reminiscent of sheet metal falling from a truck. Turning white, the fat foreigner tumbled backwards into the barrel of Kirsch herring, sending a fountain of brine into the air. Then came a second miracle. Having fallen into the barrel, the lilac man screamed in pure Russian, without a trace of accent.
"Murder! Police! These bandits are trying to kill me!"
The shock of the attack had evidently given him mastery of a hitherto unknown language. The doorman's whistling stopped, and 2 approaching police helmets appeared in the crowd of excited customers. But the treacherous Behemoth doused the confectionery counter with spontaneously igniting petrol from his primus, as one douses a bathhouse bench with water from a pail. Flames shot upwards and ran along the counter, consuming the pretty paper ribbons decorating the baskets of fruit. Salesgirls ran screaming from the counter. As soon as they cleared it, the linen curtains of the windows burst into flames and the floor caught on fire. Raising a desperate cry, the crowd dashed back from the confectionery department, flattening the now unnecessary Pavel Yosifovich, while the salesman from the fish counter trotted off towards the back door in a single file, carrying their sharp knives. The lilac gentleman managed to tear himself out of the barrel. All covered in herring juice, he rolled over the salmon on the counter and followed the fish salesman. The glass rang and shattered in the mirrored doors, knocked out by the escaping customers. As for the 2 scoundrels, Korofioff and the gluttonous Behemoth, they both disappeared, though no one knew where. Later, witnesses to the fire would say that the 2 hooligans floated up towards the ceiling and popped there like children's balloons. The story sounds a little dubious, of course, but we simply don't know. We do know, however, that exactly 1 minute after the incident on Smolensky, both Korofioff and Behemoth turned up on the boulevard pavement directly opposite Griboyedov's aunt's house. Korofioff stopped by the fence and said,
"Hey, why, that's the writer's house. You know, Behemoth, I've heard a great many good and flattering things about this place. Look at it, my friend. How lovely it is to consider the abyss of ripening talent concealed under that roof." "Like pineapples in a greenhouse," Behemoth said, and climbed up on the concrete base of the cast-iron fence to get a better look at the cream-coloured house with columns. "Quite right," Korofioff agreed with his inseparable companion. "What a pleasant thrill it is to know that this building may contain the future author of a Don Quixote or a Faust or, hell knows, a Dead Souls, huh?"
"A frightening thought," Behemoth confirmed.
"Yes," Korofioff went on. "I bet there are amazing things in the hotbeds of this house that has united thousands of devotees under its roof, men selflessly dedicating their lives to the service of Melpomene, Polyhymnia and Thalia." Can you imagine the excitement when one of them surprises the reading public with an Inspector General, or, at the very least, a Eugene Onegin?
I very easily can,
Behemoth again confirmed.
Indeed,
Karavyov continued, raising his finger in warning.
But I say, and I repeat, but none of it will happen if these tender greenhouse plants are attacked by some microorganism, some pest gnawing at their roots until they rot. And it can happen to pineapples, you know. Boy, how it can.
By the way,
Behemoth inquired, sticking his round head between the bars of the fence,
what are they doing on that veranda?
Having dinner,
Karofyov explained.
I should add, my dear fellow, that there is a very decent and inexpensive restaurant here, and I have to admit that as any tourist before continuing his journey, I would greatly appreciate a bite to eat and a tall, icy mug of beer.
Me too,
Behemoth replied, and the two scoundrels headed down the asphalted path under the lindens, directly towards the veranda of the unsuspecting restaurant. A pale, bored lady, in white socks and a white tasselled beret, was sitting on a Viennese chair at the corner of the veranda, near an opening in the green trellis that formed the entrance. A thick, ledger-like book lay before her on a plain kitchen table, where, for purposes unknown, she recorded the names of everyone who entered the restaurant. It was she who stopped Karavyov and Behemoth.
"Your membership cards?"
she asked, gazing in surprise at Karavyov's pince-nez, and also at Behemoth's primus and the torn elbow of his suit.
"A thousand pardons? What membership cards?"
asked Karavyov, also surprised.
"Are you writers?" the lady asked in turn.
"Absolutely,"
Karavyov said with dignity.
"Your membership cards?"
the lady repeated.
"My precious,"
Karavyov began tenderly.
"I'm not precious," the lady interrupted.
"That's too bad,"
Karavyov said disappointedly and continued.
"Very well, then. Since you prefer not to be precious, as nice as that would have been, I'm not going to force you. Anyhow, would you need Dostoevsky's membership card to know he's a writer? Just take any random 5 pages from any of his novels and you'll see, without any need for membership cards, that you are dealing with a writer. Why, I suspect he never even had a membership card. What do you think?"
He turned to Behemoth.
"I'll bet he didn't,"
Behemoth replied, setting his primus down next to the book and wiping the sweat from his sooty forehead.
"You are not Dostoevsky," the lady said, confused by Karavyov.
"Well, who's to say? Who's to say?"
he replied.
"Dostoevsky's dead,"
the lady said, but without much confidence.
"I protest,"
Behemoth exclaimed passionately.
"Dostoevsky is immortal."
"Your membership cards, gentlemen," the lady said.
"Forgive me, but in the end, this is ridiculous,"
Karavyov said, refusing to give up.
"A writer is defined by his writing, not by his membership card. What do you know of the plot ideas that may be swarming in my head, or in this head?"
He pointed to Behemoth, who immediately removed his cap, as if to allow the lady to get a better look at his head.
"Let the man by, gentlemen," the lady said nervously.
Karavyov and Behemoth stepped aside and made way for a writer with a newspaper tucked under his arm, wearing a grey suit without a tie and a white summer shirt with its broad collar folded over his jacket collar. The writer nodded amiably to the lady, signed something in the book offered to him, and proceeded to the veranda.
"Alas, not for us,"
Karavyov said mournfully.
"That icy mug of beer is destined for him, not for us, no matter how much we two wandering souls yearn for it. Our situation is difficult and saddening, and I don't know what to do."
Behemoth spread his hands bitterly and replaced the cap on his round head, full of thick hair very similar to cat's fur. And at that moment, a quiet but forceful voice sounded over the lady's head.
"Let them in, Sofia Pavlovna."
The lady with the book looked up in amazement. The buccaneer's white-shirted chest and wedge-like beard appeared in the trellis opening. He was gazing affably at the dubious, ragged couple and even gesturing to them invitingly. Archibald Archibaldovich made his authority well known in the restaurant he managed, and therefore Sofia Pavlovna asked Korofyov obediently, "What's your name?"
"Panayev,"
he replied politely. The lady recorded the name and directed a questioning look at Behemoth.
"Skibichovsky,"
squeaked Behemoth, pointing to his primus for some reason. Sofia Pavlovna recorded that as well and pushed the book towards the visitors so that they could sign it. Korofyov wrote Skabichovsky next to Panayev, while Behemoth signed Panayev opposite Skabichovsky. Completely astounding Sofia Pavlovna, Archibald Archibaldovich smiled seductively and led the guests to his best, most shaded table on the opposite side of the veranda. Shining through one of the gaps in the trellis growth, sunlight danced happily next to the table. Blinking with amazement, Sofia Pavlovna studied the two curious signatures left in the book by the unexpected visitors for a long time. Archibald Archibaldovich surprised the waiters no less than he did Sofia Pavlovna. He personally moved the chair away from the table, inviting Korofyov to sit. He winked at one waiter, whispered something to another, and both waiters began fussing around the new guests, one of whom had set his primus down on the floor next to his reddish boot. The old yellow-stained tablecloth vanished from the table to be replaced by a pristine starched one, whiter than a Bedouin's burnous. Archibald Archibaldovich leaned close to Korofyov's ear and whispered softly but very expressively, "What will I be treating you to? I have some very fine smoked sturgeon. Managed to rescue it from the architect's banquet."
"Would you, some appetizers,
Korofyov murmured pleasantly, sprawling in his chair. "Understood," Archibald Archibaldovich replied meaningfully, closing his eyes. Seeing the way the chief was treating the dubious clients, the waiters abandoned all doubts and began work in earnest. One was already offering a match to Behemoth, who had fished a cigarette butt out of his pocket and placed it in his mouth. Another ran up with tinkling green glassware and began laying out various wine glasses, tumblers, and those lovely thin-walled glasses that are so good for... No, skipping ahead a bit. Let us say, used to be so good for a drink of mineral water under the canopy of the unforgettable Griboyedov veranda. "Some fillet of grouse, perhaps?" Archibald Archibaldovich purred sweetly. Gazing benevolently through his useless lens, the visitor in the cracked pince-nez fully approved the brig commander's suggestions. The novelist, Petrakov Sukhovey, was dining at a neighbouring table with his wife, who was just finishing a pork chop. Observant, like all writers, he quickly noticed Archibald Archibaldovich's pandering and found it very, very surprising. As for his wife, a most respectable lady, she simply became jealous of the pirate's treatment of Korofyov. She even tapped her spoon on her glass as if to say, "What's the hold-up? It's time to serve the ice cream already. What's the matter?" Directing a seductive smile at Madame Petrakov, Archibald Archibaldovich sent a waiter in her direction and stayed with his special guests. A smart man, that Archibald Archibaldovich, and no less observant than any writer. Archibald Archibaldovich had heard of the séance at the Variety, as well as many other recent events, but unlike others, he had not forgotten the words checked suit or the word cat. Archibald Archibaldovich guessed right away who his visitors were, and naturally sought no confrontation with them. That Sofia Pavlovna was quite something, though. To think, trying to bar those two from entering the veranda. Then again, what could you expect from her? Haughtily poking her melting vanilla ice cream with her spoon, Madame Petrakov looked on in dissatisfaction as all manner of foodstuffs appeared magically on the table occupied by the two buffoons. Clean, sparkling leaves of lettuce were already sticking out from a bowl of fresh caviar. Another instant, and a misty silver ice bucket appeared on a specially prepared table nearby. Only after making sure that everything was nice and proper, only when a covered, simmering pan appeared in the waiter's hands, did Archibald Archibaldovich permit himself to leave the mysterious visitors, and only after whispering, "I beg pardon, just 1 minute, I'll go see to the fillets personally." He fluttered away from the table and disappeared inside the restaurant. Were someone to have observed Archibald Archibaldovich's subsequent actions, they would have undoubtedly seemed somewhat puzzling. Instead of heading to the kitchen to attend to the fillets, the chief visited the restaurant's storeroom. He opened it with his own key and locked himself inside. Taking care not to dirty his cuffs, he extracted 2 heavy fillets of smoked sturgeon from the icebox, wrapped them in newspaper, tied them neatly with a string, and put them aside. He then checked for his silk-lined summer coat and hat in the neighbouring room. Only then did he proceed to the kitchen, where the chef was carefully slicing the fillets promised by the pirate to his guests. Truth be told, there was nothing strange or mysterious about Archibald Archibaldovich's actions. Only a superficial observer would have found them odd, for his actions flowed quite logically from all that had occurred before. Knowledge of recent events, and above all, Archibald Archibaldovich's phenomenal intuition, told the Griboyedov restaurant chief that although his visitor's dinner would be plentiful and sumptuous, it would also be quite brief. The buccaneer's intuition had never failed him before, and it did not let him down this time. Just as Korovyov and Behemoth were clinking their 2nd glasses of excellent, cold, double-filtered Moscow vodka, a sweaty and excited reporter, Boba Kandalupsky, known in Moscow for his uncanny omniscience, appeared on the veranda and quickly joined the Petrikov's table. Placing his bulging briefcase on the table, Boba immediately thrust his mouth in Petrikov's ear and began to whisper some clearly juicy rumours into it. Burning with curiosity, Madame Petrikov also put her ear to Boba's plump, oily lips. Glancing round furtively, Boba went on whispering, and one could occasionally make out words such as, "I swear, on Sadovaya, on Sadovaya." Boba lowered his voice even further. "Bullets were useless. Bullets, bullets. Petrol, fire, bullets." "They really ought to straighten out the liars who are spreading these filthy rumours," Madame Petrikov boomed indignantly in contralto, somewhat louder than Boba would have liked. "They'll get what's coming to them, I'm sure. Such subversive lies." "Who's lying, Antonida Porfiryovna?" Boba exclaimed, upset by her disbelief, and went on buzzing. "I tell you, the bullets had no effect. And then the fire? They flew away, flew away." Boba hissed, completely unaware that the main characters in his story were sitting nearby, taking great delight in his buzzing. The delight was short-lived, however. 3 tightly belted men in leggings walked swiftly from inside the restaurant, carrying revolvers.
"Freeze!"
the one in front shouted in a loud and fearsome voice, and all 3 men instantly opened fire, aiming at the heads of Korovyov and Behemoth. Both targets dissolved immediately into the air, and a wall of fire shot out of the Primus straight into the veranda canopy. A gaping hole with blackened edges appeared in the canopy and began to spread. Breaking through the canopy, the fire quickly reached the roof of Griboyedov House. Various papers and folders ignited on the windowsill of the editorial room upstairs. Then a curtain burst into flames, and finally the pillars of fire headed inside the building, humming as if someone were fanning them. Several seconds later, leaving dinners unfinished, writers and waiters ran down the asphalted paths leading to the cast-iron fence of the boulevard, along with Sofia Pavlovna, Boba, Madame Petrikov, and Petrikov himself. It was here that Ivan, the misunderstood herald of disaster, appeared on Wednesday night. Having slipped out through the side entrance well in advance of it all, Archibald Archibaldovich stood calmly on the street in his silk-lined summer coat, without rushing anywhere, like a captain who must be the last to leave his burning brig. 2 large sturgeon fillets were tucked under his arm.